Welcome to the Ian Bousfield Experience. I'm glad you're here. This series of podcasts are just things that come up in my mind when I'm thinking about playing, when I'm thinking about teaching, and general thoughts about music. There are some things here that I hope you'll find really useful. And don't forget, if you've got any comments or if there's anything you want to discuss further, go to ianbousfield.com.
Hello. I speak to you from my basement, from my practice room. Too many noisy kids running around and screaming upstairs. I normally say to you, I speak to you from the beautiful Switzerland, looking out at the wonderful sunny meadows. And apart from the fact that it's raining most of the time this summer, it's the school holidays, so it's a bit noisy. Long time no speak. I know I say that every time these days. But I've been a bit confused as to know what to say to you. And I've also was a bit worried that if I did a podcast, I might get deplatformed. For reasons you may understand later in this podcast. Before we go any further, I would like to really thank you all so much for your support. I started doing these podcasts sort of shortly before the first lockdown 18 months ago. You know, you remember the one? Flatten the curve, that one. And I haven't actually been able to see any of you live since then. Well, I went to Sweden a couple of weeks ago to the Biba festival, the best brass festival in the world, in my opinion. And so many people came to me and thanked me for doing this. And it meant so much to me. And they said it meant so much to them, and they'd really helped them get through some difficult times, which we've all been going through, you know. And so thank you. I haven't done this before. I never realized, you see, I come into a room and talk into my computer and it gets launched, and some people sort of post comments on disagreeing with me and or laughing at me, which is fair enough, and that's it, it's gone. But I hadn't realized how many people were actually listening until I looked at the analytics, and I've got these comments back from you. So thank you so much for being there and listening. Well, I've got some things to talk to you about. They've been kind of like fermenting for a couple of months. And a lot of it is based around this BIBA, Biba, Blekinge International Brass Academy, because they asked me to do a talk there, and it brought a lot of things to the surface for me. And I was reminded that 10 years ago, I did a talk there called The Village Musician. It was almost 10 years to the day that I did another talk. Now, the idea of The Village Musician is the origins of music, the origins of us as musicians. That if you go back probably millennia, when there were the congregations of human beings starting to live together, there would be a healer, you know, there would be a spiritual person, and there would be somebody who told tales, who talked about legends, who sung, who played an instrument, would be the village artist, the village communicator. That, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, is who you are. Over the years, human beings started to congregate in bigger groups, and, you know, lived in smaller towns, and we started playing in bigger groups. We started playing in chamber ensembles and orchestras, and then, you know, here we are. But what attracted you to becoming a musician is that you are that person. You are that person within a community who expresses, communicates music and creates communication through the arts, through music. You are a conduit for something greater than us that passes through us. That's why you are musicians. Now you can hear where I'm going with this. But first, I'd like to say something about the Bieber Academy. I mean, great people, really wonderfully run. Students are fantastic. I've made so many friends over the years. If you get the chance to go there, look out for it. It's really, really fantastic. Now, while I was there, I played the Rachmaninoff cello sonata. All of it. All 45 minutes of it. Recorded it on a CD, actually. It's a challenge, musically and technically, but it suits me. And they said, yeah, I'll play something in one of the concerts. And I thought, I haven't done anything with piano for 18 months. And I felt I was getting a bit lazy, so I set the challenge. Okay, I'm going to do this. And I played with the amazing Ida Moe, who I called or sent a message to a month or so beforehand and said, look, how do you feel about doing this? Because he's basically, for those of you who don't know, it's another Rachmaninoff piano concerto with a solo line on top of it. And she said, why not? Let's go for it. And she's amazing. She's fantastic. Anyway, we did it. And I didn't know how I was going to feel. I'd had kind of a good, bad, fortuitous experience in early June when, because of one of the, you know, the lockdown situations and, you know, people testing positive, so exams had to be moved around. And one of my students was doing a final recital, and he didn't have a trombone quartet, you know, or he wanted to do an octet. That wasn't going to happen. And then he wanted to do some quartets, and it was like tough, you know. So I'm actually going to stop speaking now because my cat is now. I started doing this to avoid the noise my kids are making. Now the cat is crying outside the door. I'll be right back. Cats can be quite noisy, can't they? Anyway, so I said, look, no problem. Don't worry. I'll play in the quartet. You've got enough people. And so I thought the music was easy. It was not difficult. Suits me completely. Did the rehearsals. Wonderful. Great to be playing a quartet again. There were probably a total of 15 people in the room listening to the final recital, which was excellent, by the way. So I picked up my trombone, walked on the stage, and my body went into shock. It went into absolute shock. I was shaking. I was literally, and I was standing there looking at my body and saying, what? What are you doing to me? What? Why are you doing this? Come on, don't be silly. This is what you do. And it had been such a long time. I made a, what we in England call a schoolboy error. I never even considered it. I never even thought about it. I never thought I would actually have to mentally prepare myself to play the Barber's Adagio, which suits me completely. And there I was, struggling. It's like, breathe. Come on, remember what you say to your students. Breathe. It's like, come on, what's the worst that could happen? Oh yeah, that's the worst that could happen. And it was, I guess it was okay, but it wasn't really me. So anyway, I'd had this kind of wake-up call. Actually, it's an interesting psychological insight into that, I think, because I was not down. And I thought, this is great. I've got something to work on. I can explore nerves now again from a fresh start, from a standing start, because that is like, okay, I need to work on this. Maybe I can turn this into a learning experience. So I guess, yeah, 4 weeks later, here I was, look, you've decided to do the Rachmaninoff cello sonata, you've just fallen to pieces on the Barber Adagio. What are you going to do? So all obviously it's like, okay, you can't just walk onto the stage and remember what you used to do. So I was very, very logical in my practice as to, at this point I'm going to express this, at this point I'm going to try and say this, this tone color here, sort of really trying to get the pictures and the colors going again. So I had something to think about, because the worst thing when you go on a stage is having a vacuum in your head, not knowing what you're going to do, not knowing what you're setting out to achieve emotionally or sound-wise. Because when you leave a vacuum there, that vacuum will be filled with negative thoughts that you're not very good, etc., etc. So it was like, okay, really be sure that you know what you're going to do. Came to the concert and I just didn't know what to expect at all. And I guess the best way I can describe it is at a certain point, the cognitive became intuitive. The first movement I played and it was like, okay, just try not to fall on your backside in the first 30 seconds, okay? Because within 30 seconds, it goes up to a high E flat. And so there it was, and yeah, diminuendo into nothing on the E flat, lovely. Oh, feeling good. Goes on, actually, yeah, she's gone. But it was quite conscious, quite cognitive. I kind of know what I'm doing on the trombone. I've been doing it a long time. The second movement, I got a minute or so into the second movement and something happened. It was like, this is what you do. All of a sudden, it's like something whooshed into my body, just entered, and it was like, okay. And it became more about what I wanted to say, and the instrument became less and less relevant to me. I, you know, sort of like loved it. Loved it. Who wouldn't? You get to play with Ida Mo, one of the great collaborative pianists. My niece is called Ida. It's a bit confusing. Ida Mo. And it went really well. And I'm going to say something here. Those of you who've been listening to this podcast, you will know that I try to be pathologically fair. But I'm going to say something about, I got some new equipment a month ago, 6 weeks ago. Kristen Griego sent me some slight updates to my trombone. And at the end of that Rachmaninoff cello sonata, yeah, bing, bam, 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 up to a top E. She's after 40, 45 minutes, folks, of a difficult piece. It doesn't come off your face. And I was already looking at it and thinking, hey, come on, you haven't screwed up yet. This has gone really well. And I was eyeing the octave down, because that would have worked too. And I took the opposite decision. I thought, well, hey, you know, I haven't messed up yet. Let's go for it and see what happens. And I was completely out. My face was completely out. And I just threw the air at it. I have absolutely no idea what embouchure I used. But they came steaming out. And I was surprised. I was quite surprised by what happened. And so, yeah, thank you, Kristen. Thank you very much. I'm very grateful. I did send him a text immediately afterwards. So that was just a really interesting thing about the conversion from the cognitive, you know, to the intuitive process. And that was very interesting. So there were two experiences I had there, which will help me as a teacher, and which I wouldn't have had if we hadn't had 18 months pretty much off. You know, it's like re-encountering nerves and then the intuitive, you know, this thing about just imagine what you want to do. Just think about, yeah, you know, so that was really, really very, very interesting for me. Now, going back to the slightly more contentious issue, I made a mistake in the, you know, flattening the curve lockdown. Actually, and it went on beyond that. I'm quite good on the trombone, you see. I kind of pretty much know how it works. So I was, you know, I almost didn't miss a day practicing. But I think many of us would say the first 3 months of this nightmare were some of the happiest days of our lives. If you are fortunate to live in a beautiful place, which I am, in a beautiful house. I got 3 months with my family, walking in the Alps, cooking nice meals, getting fit. It was just wonderful. Well, fit. I just going back to that Rachmaninoff concert. A few of you made joking things on the Facebook about my shirt. Do you do that to Christian Lindbergh? Do you? I ask you. Do you do that? Do you write those messages? Someone like you guys writing in, ha ha ha, laughing at my shirt. Well, fair enough. But let me just give you a bit of background on this. Before I went to Bieber, I opened the cupboard where all my concert clothes were, and just thought, nah, I'm not even going to try. I've got a long way to go before I can get back into those. And so that was the one that would fit. That was the kind of like snazzy kind of shirt that would fit. And that's what happens when you allow your six-year-old daughter to choose your new shirt. So that's, I absolve myself of any, well, no, it's not my fault. It is my fault. I put weight on. But there we go. So anyway, so the first lockdown, great, wonderful. And I what I was doing was, I was doing this thing that we like to call basic maintenance. I was going and having a warm-up and playing a few scales, broken arpeggios, you know, great couple of, you know, maybe a few long notes, that sort of thing. And then I'd play the first movement of the Bourgeois Concerto or the first page of the Frank Martin Ballade. And I decided that when that stopped happening, I'd have to start practicing again. It didn't happen. Not until around about October, November. So after about, you know, 6 to 8 months, it started to get a little bit tough. And it scared me. And to his credit, I was telling Rex Martin what I was doing. And he said, you know, kind of like, you want to watch out. Your age, you could lose it. You know, it's like, no. I checked it. It's fine. It keeps... So, you know, warm-ups, scales, arpeggios. Ah, knocked the first page of the Frank Martin Ballade out. Everything's working. It was fine. And that was a mistake for a couple of reasons. One is I was not pursuing my own artistic direction. I guess we kind of thought this was going to be over quickly, didn't we? I certainly did. I thought 3 months, done it, back to life. And I forgot to take care of myself emotionally, to take care of myself artistically. I'd forgotten that I am a village musician. I'd forgotten that I am that person, the attraction to becoming a musician. And it upsets me still now as I speak to you about it, because I think we're all still suffering. We still can't freely express ourselves in the communion of congregation, of people gathered in a room, freely experiencing something that is greater than us. And so I learned something about myself. If you give me something to do, I'll do it. Probably as well or better than anyone else. And the whole of my life has been, this happens, then this happens, and you've got this concert, then you've got to prepare this, someone's written this concerto for you, you've got to learn it, you've got this, you've got the CD to make. And it stopped. And you know what I did? Nothing. Nothing. I was without artistic direction. I was without an artistic goal in my life. I didn't realize it at the time, because like I said, I thought it was going to be a short-term thing. I'd be back to somebody else asking me to do the Rota Concerto. And not only did my playing get worse, eventually, 6 to 8 months, where I partly thought, actually partly I thought, oh, I was a bit scared, but partly it was great, good, I've got stuff to work on. Finally, I've got something to practice. But I started getting depressed. And I think I needed, and when I say depressed, I mean depressed, not like down. I mean, it was like something, this veil was descending over me. I looked in the mirror, I was old and fat, you know? Possibly one of my biggest projects in lockdown has been going bald. So who knows how much of that had to do with it, you know? But I was getting really down, as some of you may have heard in some of the podcasts. And one of the reasons why I haven't done a podcast for a while is I felt that things were processing within my body. And I realized that music is my form of spirituality. I think it's all of our forms of spirituality, whether we realize it or not. There are those people who belong, you know, to the Christian church who would say, well, they play every note for God anyway. But I think the rest of us, it's our own form of spirituality without us being able to hang it on a peg in that way, without being able to identify it in that way. And the beginning of the journey for me was, I realized that my basic technique was going. Just a... was not working effectively. And that for me is like a video game, level one. If you can't do that, you cannot go on to level two. I don't know why I've always been so hardcore about that, but it's like a computer game. If that doesn't work, do not attempt to do anything else until you've got that right. And so I started working on that. And after about 6 weeks of doing that, and I'm not kidding, my wife came up. I was practicing upstairs in the apartment upstairs, and she said, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm fine. And she said, are you watching the television? And I said, no, no. She said, but you've done that an hour a day for 6 weeks now. I said, yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's getting better. It's good. And, oh, by the way, I've got to tell you a funny story. I hope Dudley Bright doesn't mind me telling this. When he was a kid, he lived in what in England they call a semi-detached house. It's like two houses joined together, a joining wall in the middle. And the next door neighbour had a minor bird. So like a bird that would repeat things, you know. Those kind of things that say naughty words when you don't want them to. And he said the next door neighbour's minor bird used to go, wah, 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 all day long. So I think from that we can deduce what Dudley practiced a lot when he was younger. Isn't that a fantastic story? Isn't that beautiful? Anyway, so it was like, hang on, why am I so addicted to this? Why I was going upstairs to the practice room and really, really loving doing it. Now, if you do any form of meditation or of yoga, the first thing, the very first instruction you will get is feel the breath coming in and going out. Coming in and going out. So guess what I was doing for 6 weeks? And I was focusing on the sound, focusing on the air coming into my body and going out. Coming in and going out. And I was loving it. And I think that's the first thing that we have to do when we play is we have to love that. The key to beginning to be addicted to your instrument is loving the feeling of air coming in a relaxed way and going out in a relaxed way. That way you become kind of addicted to it. I remember when I was a kid, my dad talking to me about a local painter and decorator whose wife was furious with him because he used to have 1 week's holiday per year. And where I come from, the north of England, it would be 1 week in the year, either in Whitby or in Scarborough or some old northern English seaside town. And apparently he did get there on holiday. They'd go into the guest house or whatever. And he'd go walking around the town to find someone painting a wall or painting the railings outside a building, you know. And his wife was like, come on, we're on holiday. You know, what are you doing? It turned out the paint was addictive, the smell of it. Back in those days, they had chemicals in it that were addictive. And I guess I'm addicted to air coming in and going out. Isn't that a beautiful thing? Isn't that wonderful? After all of these years, I've realized why I love playing the trombone. It does great things for my body. It's like a focus. It's like a meditation. It's like a form of spirituality. Now, the reason why we like to congregate as humans, sometimes on a Sunday morning, and why we like playing in larger groups and why we like sitting in audiences is the greater the number of people, the greater the connectivity to this communication of something greater than us. It's easier in the larger groups. It's difficult on your own. It's easier to be the Beatles than to be Elvis Presley. when you're playing in a big group, in a big ensemble, in a quartet, in an octet, in a wind band, in an orchestra, that combined spirituality almost is incredible. I will never forget the slow movement of Bruckner 8 with Christian Thielemann in the Vienna Philharmonic on tour. Now that's a level of connectivity that it's almost impossible. Only the greatest geniuses, people like us, can't do that on our own. Only perhaps the greatest pianists can create that, or singers. And I also had this strange experience that, again, the wonderful thing about stopping what we were doing, it is to relearn, to rediscover, and hopefully to make sure that we never allow this to happen to us again. But again, final recitals. By the way, the final recitals in Bern this year were absolutely the finest I've heard in my life. They were wonderful. Absolute superstars, absolute heroes. Hadn't stood on a stage for 18 months like me and did amazing jobs. But in one of the recitals, final recitals, I distanced myself from the audience and the panel because I just didn't want to get too involved in anything. And also these days, it's best to keep a distance, whatever your circumstances are. Come on, we got to do what we can. So I sat upstairs on the balcony in this lovely old concert hall. And I was aware of this thing of communion, of all those gathered going to the same place the musician on the stage was taking them. And that for parts of the recital, maybe not the whole hour, but for parts of it, everybody was glued on this one thing. Everyone's focus and attention was on that. And that's what we've lost, has been taken away from us. Now, this was the bit that I didn't know how to say. And this is why I haven't done a podcast. But Anna Sophie Mutter, the great German violin virtuoso, and the singer Gerhard Herr, wonderful singer, sued the German government because it is in the German Bundesverfassung, in almost like the equivalent of their constitution, that it is illegal to remove the right of a German citizen to religious congregation and to artistic public expression, if I remember that rightly. So they sued the German government and they lost. They lost. You know why they lost? Because it was ruled that they could still perform online. That shows us only one thing. That shows us that we have a group of politicians the world over, absolutely the world over, who are utterly uncultured. Now, yeah, I know. Listen, I am not saying the concerts should have carried on as they should have done. I am not dismissing in any way the severity of the situation we find ourselves in as a species. And I am not saying I could necessarily have done a better job. I do. My heart goes out to them. They wanted to just, you know, feet on the desk, plan a few motorways, build a new airport with their name on it. And this happened. So it hasn't been easy for them. But the failure to recognize art, live art, communal art, as being part of the human disposition, has been something that should never have happened. It's been utterly dismissed. It is not the same online. It is not the same on a computer. And if we have politicians who believe it is, then that's where our work must begin, to educate these people. People have written to me, you know, and said, well, what's the positive way out of this? I think we're already in trouble. I think the way out of this is, when this is over, we may never let arts be sidelined. We may never accept politicians who would sideline this part of humanity with just a mere brush of the hand. Off Goodbye. It's part of what we are as a species, that is our work. If we have alienated, and it may be our fault, if we have alienated ourselves from society, from community, in such a way that not only are politicians elected who pay lip service only to the importance of the arts, then we must ask ourselves what we have done to create this situation. I think this is the big wake-up moment for us. It's like, oh, but how can they do this to us? Yeah, hang on a minute. What have we done to create this situation? How have we alienated ourselves to this extent? So that was the bit that I was struggling as to how to say that to you. I think in Scandinavia, I think they worked harder than anyone else to try and keep the arts going. You know, that orchestras doing amazing things like converting buses so they could actually, with a sort of rollout platform, so they could go outside schools, outside old people's homes, and play for them, you know. Wonderful, fantastic. There was just not enough of that happening, you know. And I think we didn't, in fact, I thought, 12 weeks? Sure, yeah, we need to do this. And of course, we couldn't just expect it, like I say, to continue. Although I would at this point say politicians have been telling us they've been following the science, the science. There are now enough peer-reviewed scientific research papers that show that there is negligible to almost to zero transmission in a concert hall. That science they did not follow. They selectively followed the science because, just easier, don't do concerts. It's just easier just to say that. And like I say, yeah, what would I have done in the same situation? I don't know. It's easy for me to sit on the sidelines and go crazy about this. But I think that's something I'd like you to think about. What can you do in your lives in the future to make the arts more important to society, make your role more important in society? How are you going to draw people in? And I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole of, are you surprised if people don't come to your concerts anymore if you play something that sounds like a road traffic accident? So I'm not going to go in that regard. But, and you know, we can't make, you know, André Rieu Minister for Culture in every country in the world. but that, like I say, that is our work. And I'm old. It's you young people who are listening to this. This is your role. How are you going to make yourself more important to society? Now, as you know, I record these things like stream of nonsense as opposed to a stream of consciousness. And I don't really plan this stuff very much out. I realize I didn't go back to explain what I do to deal with the spiritual aspect of practicing, of playing, when I'm on my own, when we can't do what we're supposed to do. I'm pretty much unemployed at the moment as a soloist and a conductor. I had some great projects for the summer, really amazing ones, but they've all one by one been cancelled. And starting September, I have amazing projects again. Really fantastic projects every month going right through. And boy, if they don't happen, wow, I don't know. That's going to be tough. But anyway, the spiritual aspect of things. I take time every day to play melodies for myself. Not just to make a pretty sound. Not just to make my best, darkest, most macho noise, not to make, you know, the most sustained, you know. It's like, it's, I do it for me. I might make up a melody, I might play a melody that suits my style, my emotion, my feeling at the time. I might play a hymn tune, and it's purely on that, trying to connect with, I keep, you know, this thing about, like I've said so many times before, the word genius is so lightly used. He's a genius. She's a genius. No. Genius is something that we have the ability to access if we get things right. It doesn't belong to us. It's this thing that can pass through us. And someone like me occasionally in life manages to touch that. Someone like Daniel Barenboim or someone like a Pavarotti, for example, lived there. You know, they live there. They can just permanently access it. So I do my best to try and access that every day to nourish me, to remind me of what it is that I do and why I want to play music. So give it a try. Just play for yourself. Play. And it's not just called playing for fun. It's called taking the breath in and releasing it and creating something. Trying to access something. Trying to create something special. That was something else that became clear to me that I think might be going back to, you know, where we're getting things wrong, what we're doing wrong. For me, I realized that performance is about creating special moments. And I've said this so many times before, so please forgive me for repeating myself. But it's about creating something that the listener may remember on their way home. If you're lucky, a week later. If you're incredibly fortunate like me, you'll remember a lifetime later. And these things happen in 20 seconds. They don't happen in an hour or 2 hours or 20 minutes. They happen in 20 seconds or 5 seconds or maybe a minute where something otherworldly, and I didn't turn my Wi-Fi off, so I just got a ping. My brother sent me a message. So it's this creating something touching and special. And you all know what I'm talking about. When you think back to the most amazing things you've ever heard, you don't think back to an hour. It's this one moment of absolute beauty in creation. And so I realise that's what I'm a bit of an experience junkie, not only in concerts, but in life. And for me, it's like, what do they always say about family holidays? They're about creating memories. And we just had a fantastic holiday last week, actually, in Austria. It was wonderful. But that's what we're trying to do when we perform. Create things that people can take home and remember. And I think the more we go for, in inverted commas, perfection of articulation and of intonation and of sound and playing lovely, long, flat, straight notes. And what the heck does that have to do with creating special moments? There's something else I'd like you to really think about. That's again, another realization that I've had over the last 18 months. And I'm not giving you any answers, am I? Welcome to my teaching room. I tend not to. This is another podcast that I need to do, but on teaching. You know, it's like at a certain point, you have to stop instructing and you have to start suggesting. You have to start showing a room. Go into this room and you'll find something that will help you. Go and look for this. Go and try and, what do you want to create? What is it you want to do? And I'm not giving you any answers to this. I'm telling you how I do things, and you'll work out how you do it yourself. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. If there are any issues that you found particularly interesting, don't forget to contact me, and always go to ianbousfield.com for lots more interesting stuff.